everyone, and welcome back to the Strike and Ellicott Files, an unofficial podcast dedicated to all things Cormoran Strike and Robin Ellicott, as written by Robert Galbraith. My name is Kenz.
I'm Lindsay.
And I'm Pools.
And today we'll be continuing our reread of The Running Grave, covering chapters 96 and 97 of part 7. Please be aware, as always, that our discussion of The Running Grave will often reference the ending of this book, as well as the previous books in the series.
All right, for our listener question today, I really wanted to talk about a response we got to episode 27, where we were talking about the ceramic stag head in the hotel room.
So Ren Anderson over on Twitter said, regarding the ceramic stag's head in Felberg Lodge, this is waste. Artemis has taken his head. I recall some myth where a fellow crosses Artemis, she turns him into a stag and his own men kill him. Does anybody know more about this? And then followed up in another tweet with, looked it up. Artemis was bathing in her forest pool at night. No mention of it being pentagonal. Actaeon saw her and made an unwanted assault on her, and she turned him into a stag. He ran off and his own pack of hunting dogs hounded and slew him. And now his head is in Felberg Lodge.
I love this comment, and I think it's much more accurate than just reminding us of Harry Potter. I love the connection to Artemis being in water right before this happens too. Very appropriate with Robin in the pool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is such a brilliant catch. And you're right. It makes so much more sense than the incredibly tenuous Petros idea I had. Waze's head being chopped off and mounted as a trophy symbolically is much more satisfying to me than that anyways. So
I mean, I wouldn't mind if it wasn't even symbolically.
Yeah, do it.
Off with his head.
Yeah, off with his head. I love it.
Yeah, obviously, I can't say for sure because I've never actually been to this hotel, obviously, but I went online and I looked at some pictures. I saw a ceramic stag head on the wall in a different room, not the one Strike and Robin were in. But since I can't see all the angles of the room, I can't say whether or not it's only in the separate room. Do you know what I mean? But if this ceramic head is in a different room and Joe chose to place it in this room just for the book, it would suggest a significance to me.
Yeah.
And I think Ren is absolutely right that it has to do with Robin being Artemis. One thing that I found interesting about this story, it says that Artemis was bathing and was seen by Actaeon. So she turned him into a stag. She didn't kill him herself. After she turned him into a stag, it says that he was then killed by his own hunting dogs. So what Artemis does was she made him more vulnerable to attack so that his own people, own dogs, could finish the job. Yep. I think you can make an argument that this is what's happening here with Wace. Robin does all the work to expose him and make him vulnerable, but she also got Wace's own people to turn on him. And those are the testimonies that they've been saying they needed since the very beginning. Will, Lynn, Flora, Emily, Robin might have set him up, but it's his own people who will pull the trigger, so to speak. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that absolutely makes sense to me. His tools, the people he thought he had control over, his pack, that was his downfall. He's about to be torn to pieces.
Yeah. And I also like Actaeon being Jonathan Wace because he was a hunter too, but ended up being the hunted by a better hunter. And Wikipedia says that Actaeon can symbolize human sacrifice or human curiosity. Both fit with Wace and the UHC.
Yeah.
It also says the myth is seen by Jungian psychologist Wolfgang Giegerich as a symbol of spiritual transformation and or enlightenment. So I think that also fits really well with the whole spiritual stuff, right?
Yeah, it really kind of does. As I was looking this up, I had another thought too. This myth of Actaeon, Shakespeare references this in Twelfth Night. Orsino uses it as a metaphor for his unrequited love.
Interesting.
So maybe I can make some kind of very tortured connection. To the blog post that I'm totally writing right now.
And just as a follow-up to this, we did have a listener question that we got a while back from OAlexandraO on Instagram that says, would love to delve a bit more into the parallels between Robin and the Artemis nickname Wace gives her, which we have done that, but the next bit is something interesting too. And if there are any other parallels we can draw between characters outside of the compound, i.e. Strike and Murphy, and potential Greek mythical counterparts. So I'm in no way an expert on this. I mean, most of my knowledge of Greek mythology comes from Disney's Hercules. Who put the glad in gladiator?
Hercules.
But I kind of want to make an argument for Strike being Apollo, as long as we just ignore the whole sibling thing. So Artemis and Apollo are twins, but I think that could work if you look at them as like a pair, a team, you know?
Yeah, it totally could. Sorry, I'm still laughing at the Disney Hercules thing. That's amazing. Yeah. I mean, it's a good movie. Top two songs.
Someone call IXII. I love that line.
So funny.
And to be fair, most of my knowledge of Greek mythology comes from a novel that I think was called Gods Behaving Badly, and it's not a reliable source. But yeah, I think that Artemis and Apollo could work. And, you know, Wikipedia says that in the pre-Hellenic era, they were actually husband and wife.
Well, there you go.
And it did say citation needed, but, you know,
let's go with it.
Would be on Wikipedia if it weren't true.
Of course.
Yeah, obviously.
But I just wanted to read a few things that I found on this one site that was just giving me Strike and Robin vibes. And this is from thecollector.com. And it's an article called Apollo and Artemis, the Divine Twins with Opposing Aims. So some of the stuff about opposition was just talking about Apollo being the sun and Artemis being the moon. It talks about the chastity of Artemis versus the promiscuity of Apollo, which maybe not totally off there.
Yeah, you know, you're not wrong. I do love this dichotomy that you point out here because it reminds me of the epigraphs that we'll get to in a little under 30 chapters. It's chapters 128, 129, and then 131, where they alternate in the epigraphs between fire in the strike chapter and water in the robin chapter, and then 131, where they come together.
Ooh, nice. Mm-hmm. I like that. Yeah. But here are the pieces that I really liked in this article. So it says, the divine twins were effectively two sides of the same coin, inseparable yet different. One without the other was inconceivable. The symbolism of the coin with two sides was manifest in the twins' responsibilities. In Greek mythology, Apollo and Artemis each had dominion over different parts of the cycle of day to night. Apollo was given the responsibility of raising the sun each day across the sky from east to west. Naturally, his sister Artemis drew the moon across the sky throughout the night. As such, Apollo became associated with golden light and Artemis silver light. Overall, Artemis and Apollo worked in tandem to bring light to the world. And I mean, is that not exactly what Strike and Robin do together?
That's them.
Yeah, they are two sides of the same coin who bring light to the world.
And in this book, they're on separate shifts.
Yeah,
you know, Strike is in the daylight and Robin is working by moonlight.
Exactly.
Going to bring him the notes. Yes.
Yeah. I like that a lot. Yeah. It also says, together they represent the impossibility of having one side of something without the other. Without the light, there would be no moon. Their opposites and parallels signify the duality of mankind through divine expression.
Oh, I love that. I love the sort of symbolic interpretation you've set up here so much. I was looking into Apollo, and Britannica says that he was the god who made men aware of their own guilt and purified them of it.
Ooh, purify them with punches to the face.
Or wire cutters is the case.
Yeah,
maybe.
Wire cutters. Yeah. And he's also, interestingly, the god of music.
Ooh.
Mm, and I could see a connection somehow, tortured, between this and the Denmark Street daddy issue repression that's going on with Strike, you know?
Yeah, I just think that's so sweet when you think of Strike and Robin and their partnership.
Yeah.
And one bit that just reads very Strike to me says, in Greek myth, Apollo's anger would often cause him to vengefully strike down offenders with his golden arrows. But in other cases, Apollo would be the savior to lots of people. So he earned the epithet Agios. Don't know if I'm saying that right, but it means protector or defender. And that's Strike, right? He's going to punch a bad dude who pisses him off. But he's also a protector of the vulnerable.
Yeah. Protector, as is Artemis. I like that. Oh, and you know what? The moon and the sun are very yin and yang coded.
Yes.
The complementary forces of dark and light, moon and sun, fire and water, fits with the I Ching framing of the text.
It does, yeah. It also talks about conflict and rivalry between Apollo and Artemis. And I don't think there's ever rivalry between Strike and Robin. But yeah. They've certainly had conflict, all while still coming together for their end goal, right?
Marriage. Yes.
Yeah. Marriage.
Not in the Targaryen way.
The listener question asks about Murphy, too. I was thinking Orion, a man she came close to marrying, and Apollo was not having it. So he tricked Artemis into killing Orion.
Damn.
So maybe if Murphy kicks the bucket in the Hallmark
Damn,
man.
That got dark really quickly. Jesus, Lynch.
It just gives me vibes of Strike sitting there and wishing for Murphy to screw up so badly that it ends the relationship, you know?
Oh, I love that. Although you can't say Orion without my brain immediately saying Orion's belt.
Right.
And then going to the cat in Men in Black.
Men in Black, yeah.
That was a really cute key cat.
The galaxy is on Orion's
belt. That was such a good movie.
I love Men in Black. I need to watch that.
I want to watch that right now, too. Oh, that was such a good movie. I can't believe we've both seen a movie. But yes, this is funny and brilliant. And I can absolutely see the Murphy parallels, and I'm here for it.
In other versions, Orion becomes a bit dangerous, sort of. So she kills him. But that different version fits nicely with us not knowing how Murphy's going to end up behaving, you know?
Right? Like, is he going to secretly be a crooked cop?
I doubt
smuggling
it.
Silver?
I doubt it. But,
well,
you know.
Maybe. Yeah.
Here's an alternate for Murphy. Brotius.
The bro tea. I think it's bro teas, which is a brand of tea for bros.
Okay. However you say it, he was a famous hunter who refused to honor Artemis and boasted that nothing could harm him, not even fire. It says Artemis then drove him mad, causing him to walk into fire, ending his life.
Wow. Well, you know, he fucked around and he found out.
It's just the refusing to honor Artemis kind of gives, you know, some of the things we've talked about in the past. I promise I'm not actually over here rooting for Murphy's horrible death.
I think that I encouraged you when I asked whether or not you thought Murphy was going to get stabbed. And now you're just, your brain's going to romp through that meadow.
I don't know. Just for fun, can Narcissus be Matthew?
Narcissus, yes.
I can quote Hercules again. I haven't seen this much love in one room since Narcissus discovered himself.
I love that.
I don't think that Murphy is going to go the distance, though, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
No. No, yeah. Definitely not.
Yeah, we get it.
Thank you. Anyway, I don't know if J.K. Rowling's actually making these kind of parallels, but it is fun. Right. I mean, definitely Robin and Artemis is there, obviously.
Yes.
But yeah, I'm going with Apollo for Strike. Yeah, I like it.
It is fun. It is interesting.
Let's go to chapter 96.
In chapter 96, Strike fires Little John.
Woohoo!
Yes. All right. And then the epigraph for this chapter. Punishment is never an end in itself, but serves merely to restore order. And that is from Hexagram 4, Youthful Folly.
I think this is probably just talking about punishing Little John by firing him and restoring order to the agency.
Yeah, absolutely. The firing was necessary. Although I will say that Strike is definitely enjoying the punishment as an end in itself here.
Yeah, he is.
But you know, he's earned it. He can have a little fun punishing Little John as a treat. Also note that this is the Youthful Folly hexagram, but Little John's folly cannot be excused by youth. He's just an idiot.
Mm-hmm.
Good riddance.
The chapter starts with Strike and Robin finding Cherie's house empty, so they decide to wait at a pub for a while.
So I'm guessing that Cherie is out of the house because of that phone call from Abigail?
Ooh.
Like, because I'd imagine she got the call, got her kids out of there in a panic to figure out what to do with them, and then stayed away for as long as she could, hoping that the detectives would miss her and just give up and go home.
I didn't think of that, but yeah.
Ooh, yeah. Mm.
I wonder if she was already considering the possibility of suicide, depending on how much they knew, and that's one of the reasons why she wanted her kids gone.
Oh god.
On to more pleasant, funny things. Poor Strike. They get there too early for lunch. He has to settle for eating peanuts. Poor guy.
And zero alcohol beer.
Well, that's his own choice because it's less calories.
But still tragic.
Still a little tragic.
Luckily, he's cheered up by Barkley's text.
As am I. Barkley truly is so eloquent. He says so much with just one word. Shafted.
This line is so funny when it says, Robin started laughing again as she saw her partner's expression change to one of pure glee. The news story, which was brief, was headed, breaking, tabloid's favorite private eye arrested. I love how much Robin is laughing in these chapters, even with their fight. She's just laughing so much because she's back working with Strike.
She missed him so much. And I miss
them. And I miss them. Yeah.
But these moments are so much sweeter after so much suffering, don't you think?
Yes. And I do think that J.K. Rowling gave us so much of them together because of that separation.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just picturing Strike's face. When has his expression ever been described as changing to pure glee? It's just, oh, and then he laughs so loudly that people look so cute.
Yeah, that literally never happens.
The last time people were looking at them laughing was at the Brits because they were laughing so much. Oh my God.
I know. I just love seeing them both so happy and laughing after all those chapters and after the fight too.
It's almost like they make each other really happy.
Oh, it is almost like that.
Strike then says that he can now fire Little John, which is very exciting.
Oh, it is. Someone's birthday came early this year.
I love Robin asking if her presence is necessary while at the same time she's already getting up to go and smiling. It's so funny. Like, don't pretend you don't want to be there, Robin.
Right. Oh, Strike's comment about how Barkley would have paid money to watch it really cracked me up.
I feel like she really should have recorded this whole thing on her phone for Barkley. I mean, is that not what friends do?
FaceTimed him.
Yeah. Yeah, but really, Barclay not witnessing this, is it's breaking tradition. He was in the audience for Morris, and it was delightful. He should be here. Team bonding.
When it comes to the actual firing, does anyone feel bad for Little John?
Absolutely not. Off you fuck, Little John.
Yeah. Not really. Funny. Too much sympathy in my heart for him.
Yeah.
It's so funny to me, this quote. The jauntiness of Little John's tone suggested his duplicitous subcontractor didn't yet realize Patterson had been arrested, and Strike's pleasurable anticipation increased. He is savoring being able to completely pull the rug out from under Little John. He's been waiting for his revenge so long, and now it's here and it's delicious. And even better, because it's completely unexpected.
When Little John said he had more on the UHC for Strike, what was that? I can't remember.
I'm pretty sure it was nothing, that he was just making shit up to try and keep his job, which is a pretty stupid plan, given that he wouldn't have been able to deliver. But okay, he's not a real smart guy.
It's like, I can bluff it for long enough until I can find something that I can say is new.
I love Robin laughing at Strike here and her comment about them being lucky that they don't have an HR department. But is anyone else worried that Strike just made a bitter enemy in Little John and that he might come back later seeking revenge? Because, I mean, I'm not too worried because Strike and Robin would have no trouble outsmarting this guy. But still, could he not cause trouble? Because he's going to have a huge grudge against them now.
Maybe. Or maybe it's just kind of like Morris. But Strike is also right that he has some good leverage on him, right? He did put a snake through a woman's door, a client.
True.
I don't know. Yeah. We'll see.
The chapter ends with Strike implying that he's changed the lock so skeleton keys won't work, and then giving Robin a new set of keys.
Good thing he did this because of Little John, because he wasn't even suspecting that someone more dangerous was going to try and break in. He also put a camera up too, right?
Yep.
Why am I having fantasies now of Strike and Robin kissing on the landing and Pat checking the video?
Oh my God, that would be adorable. They'd have their first kiss on video. If that's smart, she'll sell that tape to Ilsa to play at their wedding. Because Ilsa would pay. Ilsa would pay big money for that footage. Mm-hmm.
If she starts a GoFundMe, I'll donate. Yeah.
I'd donate.
No, I'm imagining it because Robin, she's going to be the one to go find Strike, right? To tell her she loves him too. She's going to go up to his flat, but he's not going to be there. And she's going to worry. And then she's going to turn around and he's going to be standing on the landing like, what's going on? Because he was in the office.
Mm-hmm. I would love that.
And then she just comes down and kisses him.
Oh my God.
Not that I've thought about this much at all. No. I mean, no.
Never.
No. Obviously. I don't ever. Okay, let's go to chapter 97.
Yes.
In chapter 97, Strike and Robin interview Cherie.
Okay, in the epigraph, Khan represents the pig slaughtered in the small sacrifice. And that's hexagram 63 after completion. You know what I think is really fun and definitely done on purpose? This epigraph mentions a pig. And obviously we're about to meet Cherie / Carrie. So the reference to a pig is tying her to the crime and to Dai's death. But remember that the epigraph for the Jordan Rini interview, chapter 56, also referenced a pig. That one said, even a lean pig has rage in him.
Ooh.
So I definitely think that Joe picked pig-related epigraphs for both of these people as clues that they were each involved.
Oh, you're totally right. I really wish I'd picked up on this earlier.
Yeah, sadly, this also does seem to warn us about Cherie's fate. Right. Mm. She's going to end up being the one slaughtered or sacrificed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's very foreboding, isn't it?
It is.
I think that this hexagram after completion could also represent Cherie's life a bit, because it says, for it is just when perfect equilibrium has been reached that any movement may cause order to revert to disorder. So there's the point where you reach the peak, but there's nowhere to go but down. You know, Cherie has this stable, happy life now. She's managed to escape what happened at Chapman Farm for all these years, but this tiny thing is going to bring the entire edifice crumbling down.
Yeah. So when they approach Cherie / Carrie, that's going to be difficult. Like, I don't know what to call her.
I'm just sticking with my own head for Cherie because I can't deal with two different names on two different times. I can't handle it. I can barely remember people's names as it is, you know?
Right.
I don't have the capacity. So I'm going to pick the one I like more. Okay. And that was the first one. And that's Cherie.
Cherie.
So maybe, like, someone else can do Carrie. And
right. Okay. Same person.
Really
we
confusing.
All know. But at the start of this chapter, it says, twice before, while working at the agency, Robin had thought a female interviewee might faint. Carrie's face lost all healthy color, leaving the surface tan, patchy, and yellow, and her lips pale. Who are the other two? Mrs. Hook? Tufty's wife?
I think those are the ones. Because Tufty's wife, she looks like she's going to for a second, and then that's when she starts.
And
like,
she goes to Kia's car.
Oh, yes.
But I think one of them was Douthwaite's wife in TV.
Oh, yes.
Her face. Because she was totally about to faint.
Yes, Donna. Mm-hmm.
Right. That's her face. Yeah.
Maybe Donna and Tufty's wife. Yeah.
Yeah.
So right away, Strike thinks that their presence isn't a total surprise to her. And he wonders if maybe she saw something about the UHC's attack on them online, or if this is just something she's been dreading for years. But really, we know that Abigail has already called her.
Yeah. This was definitely a clue.
Yeah.
And I'm certain she has been dreading this for years. And she's probably at this point still desperately hoping that Abigail was wrong and that they weren't coming to see her.
But... yeah. Okay, I have a weird question. Why is everyone in this book going to Spain? Is that normal? I mean, it's the third Spain trip we've heard about. First the Heatons, the second's Murphy, now Cherie.
Yeah. You know, I've gotten the impression that Spain is a pretty popular country to go to vacation in for folks in the UK. I don't know if you remember, you know, in Harry Potter, it talks about Aunt Marge going to Mallorca. That is an island off of the coast of Spain.
You know what's funny, though? I just was opening TikTok when we had a break a few minutes ago. And that woman that I follow, I think her username on TikTok is Yorkshire Peach.
Yeah.
She's like that American from Georgia living in England.
Yorkshire.
Mm-hmm. She posted a video that she's in Spain and it made me laugh because I knew this part was coming up. Mm-hmm. I guess, yeah.
I think part of it could be a tiny jab at Brexit voters with second homes in the EU, especially with the Heatons. But this also made me wonder if there's some kind of hidden connection with the Hallmark man, because I don't know why, but Spain and silver have like a strong association in my mind. So I Googled it and it was because in the colonial era, Spanish silver coinage, the reals, were famous throughout the world as a standard by which other coinages were measured due to its consistent weight and purity, because Spain took a shit ton of silver out of its colonies in Peru, Bolivia, Colombia, Mexico, especially. They stole a lot of, and they stole a lot of silver artworks from the indigenous people and melted them down. It does seem like a bit of a reach now that I'm saying it, though, because they're not finding a pirate hoard of Spanish reals from
the 16th century.
It would be awesome. Yeah, but
I'm all for pirates.
Probably not likely.
I did ask Anna Kiara about this, and I think Ken's might be right that it is just very common.
Yeah.
I guess it's like how everyone here goes to Hawaii or Florida. Mm-hmm. Or Vegas. Anyway, it's just so, so nice seeing Strike and Robin back together to interview people again. You just know that Robin's presence made a huge difference because Carrie was nervous and Robin knew just how to put her at ease, you know, talking about her kids and her life.
Yeah, Robin is so good at this. I really like Strike's quiet observations and thoughts about Cherie in this moment. His description of the type of personality that clings to more dominant personalities, training themselves like mistletoe on a tree, is just so vivid and so accurate. Like, I've met people like this who just turn into whatever guy they're dating. I liked him quietly sitting back and observing while Robin did what she's best at.
And yeah, I guess she didn't put her at total ease because of what happened. And I also noticed that twitch when Strike mentions Dayu's name.
As though some invisible entity had tugged her strings. That's Abigail using these people like puppets to do her bidding.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I've said before that I have complicated feelings about Cherie, and I really do. I start off feeling bad for her, you know, when she explains that the only thing that drew her to the UHC was that it was a warm place to be and that she had run away from home because she didn't get along with her mother. It says she drank, she had a new boyfriend, and And I don't know if this is a huge leap, but does anyone else get the feeling that her mother's boyfriend was being inappropriate, to put it lightly?
Yeah, I can see that. Honestly, wanting to get away from sexual abuse and her potentially alcoholic mother seems like good enough reasons as any to run off to a cult.
I got the same impression as you did, Lindsay. And I mean, depressingly common story. I felt bad for Cherie here, and I still do.
I mean, I feel bad for her too, up to a point.
Yeah.
It reminds me of some of the stories I've heard about the Manson women who ran away from home, and then that's where they ended up.
Mm-hmm.
I noticed that Robin really thinks a lot about Carrie's daughters throughout the chapter. She wonders if they have henna from Spain like Carrie does. She notices their drawings. She asks about them. I wonder if it's because she's heard so much about how all these kids loved her at the UHC and thought of her like a mother.
Cherie loving kids and being good with them seems to be the one consistent aspect of her character that stayed with her through all her sort of chameleon transformation, which makes her part in Dayu's murder even more tragic, because that's an authentic part of her, that she loves kids, that she's good with kids.
Yeah.
The guilt she's been feeling all this time must be horrible.
Remember in the last episode when I said that I understood parts of Strike judging Flora for not coming forward for justice? And I think that that's kind of coming up for me here, because I really relate to Cherie with the kid thing and how she took care of them since she was young. It makes it harder for me to understand, I think.
Yeah.
Anyway, with Carrie's kids all around, I just feel like we're being prepped to feel the weight and impact of her suicide.
Yeah, I think that's very much the case.
And it's interesting when you compare this to the other mother of two who committed suicide in this book.
Oh.
I think about Strike talking to Charlotte in the church and saying that you should have stayed alive for her kids. But it's so much harder for me to understand Carrie's choice because of this very strong love and connection she clearly has with her daughters. You know, Robin's noticing it. It's everywhere. But Charlotte, well, we know how she felt about being a mother.
I think that for sure she loves her daughter so much that having to face them finding out what she'd done would be unbearable to her. I wonder if she also feels unworthy of being their mother. Like, how can she be good for them when she did what she did, thinking they'd be better off without her, kind of thing. I can see 20 years of guilt and shame turning into this kind of self-loathing.
I can understand that that's how she might feel, because that's what people say, right? Yeah. They think people will be better off, but I just can't relate to it, if that makes sense. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
This next part is really good. It's the line after Carrie has cried all her mascara off and her eyes were puffy. It says, "Strike thought she looked like a piglet, but Robin was reminded of the teenage girls keeping vigil before the manifestation of the drowned prophet." I think this is a great line because first we have another connection to a pig.
Mm.
It sounds so bad to be comparing this woman to a pig, but it's not like that. It's just, it's connecting her to the crime, right? And I wonder if being specifically a piglet has any significance, like not the one in charge, not the physically dangerous one, but still a pig. Does that make sense?
No, that makes sense to me. I think you're right. And the piglet, it's a connection to children. Again, for her, she's associated with the babies.
And then Robin being reminded about the teenage girls keeping vigil before the manifestation of the drowned prophet. Mm-hmm. Not only does it make me think that Cherie had been young during her time at Chapman Farm, but the manifestation happens on the anniversary of Dai's death. So it's kind of like Cherie was the first young girl to keep vigil on that day. You know, she was the one who watched and made sure everyone was sleeping and handed her off out the window. I don't know if that's a stretch, but...
Ooh, that's not a stretch at all. That's really good.
Mm.
Yeah, I like that. And that's the, you know, because the smeared mascara didn't even make sense for the vigil.
That's why.
But it makes sense because it's her... Yes.
There you go. Did we ever find out if the whole thing about Dai saying she's going to live with Cherie was true? Or was it just a red herring to add to the Dai was alive somewhere theory?
I don't think we ever do. I'm pretty sure that's a red herring.
It might have been something Abigail told her to persuade her to go along with whatever it was Abigail wanted for her plans. Because I could see it being an effective manipulation tactic.
Yeah.
But it genuinely doesn't seem like Cherie had any idea about it. And it's definitely meant to suggest to us that she's still alive somewhere.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
I see another connection to Jordan Rini here. There really are a lot of things that tie them together when you actually look at it. So Strike thinks she looks unhappy that he knows there weren't clocks at Chapman Farm, in the same way Jordan Rini wasn't happy that he knew information.
And like Rini, it seems pretty easy to tell that she's lying throughout this whole interview, right?
Yeah.
Her only explanation for all this weird stuff is that she was just doing what Dai wanted to do, which is not convincing at all.
Yeah.
Even if Dai was spoiled and allowed special privileges, it still wouldn't make any sense.
When Strike asks her if she was sleeping in the children's dorm the night before they went to the beach, it says she looks uneasy when she answers yes, obviously, because that is the very night she handed Dai out the window. Mm-hmm. I'd be uneasy too if he was asking me about it.
Very, very much so, yes.
And when they talk about the other person who was supposed to be there, because there were supposed to be two teenagers, refresh my memory, was that Rose, but she escaped, or was it someone else?
No, I think it was Abigail. And she wasn't there because she was outside the window.
Right.
And then in the woods, killing Dai.
This next bit about Jordan Rini oversleeping is actually much more important than I ever gave it credit for, because Strike points out that if Cherie and Jordan were both supposed to go on the vegetable run, there wouldn't have been room for Dai in the truck.
Ooh.
Which makes it fishy that Carrie's story now is that she woke Dai up to go with her, Because how would she have known at this point that Jordan was still asleep and not going with her if he was in the men's dorms? Mm-hmm. That's a slip up, right?
Mm-hmm. Big slip up. The story doesn't make sense. And it's obvious to us and to Cherie that Strike has picked up on that.
Yeah. God, I want to be Strike and Robin when I grow up.
Same.
But of course, to counter this, her saying that it was a long time ago and she can't remember details, that's also kind of believable.
Yeah,
a bit. I mean, yes, it's completely believable to me because I can't remember a week ago, but
yeah, I was going to say,
like, yeah, I can't remember shit. Other people sometimes seem to remember like traumatic events and things that happen. So
I think Cherie actually remembers pretty much everything about this. Yeah.
Yeah. Big time.
Some of these details that we get out of this conversation are just hitting all of the important points again. There's the point about how Dayu never got out of the car because she wasn't there to begin with. Mm-hmm. Cherie carried fake Dayu down to the beach, you know, because dolls can't walk.
Right.
They took off their clothes, even though they weren't intending to go all the way in. She talks about how she got pulled under by the riptide, how she went to go get help and then ran into the Heatons.
Strike notes during all of that her voice got stronger and it seemed like she had an easier time talking about the actual drowning, which he thinks would have been the most traumatic part of her story. But it's not, is it? Because it didn't actually happen. So going to the ocean wasn't traumatic for her. But notice mm-hmm. that she doesn't like talking about the night before because that's what was actually traumatic.
Mm-hmm. Yep, that's a clue. Just seems a bit odd that something that would have been traumatic to witness wouldn't impact her like at all.
Yeah, that's why it's harder for her to talk about. Well, that and because she'll probably have rehearsed that story of the morning so many times, much more than the night before.
Yep,
definitely.
This part stands out to me when Strike asks her about Mrs. Heaton's story that Cherie ran off when the police arrived to poke at some seaweed. And Carrie is adamant that that didn't happen. And Strike notes that there's defiance in her voice.
This should be a clue that this bit is important. Right? Uh-huh. I had no chance to figure out what was important about it. I was like, seaweed?
Right.
I don't know.
Even though there had been a ton of emphasis on those corn dollies, it was never going to happen up here in my brain.
No, no. I mean, I think maybe my brain's too filled with like the romance and pining, but all there's no room for clues up here.
It's not our fault. It's hard to focus on these things when Robin is over here thinking about how happy she is to be back in the Land Rover with Strike and he's being all funny and they're laughing.
And I'm supposed to think of murder? I don't think so. No.
But yeah, interesting that she's so sure about this, that she did not do this when she says she's unsure about other things. Mm-hmm. Almost like she doesn't want anyone asking why she would be looking at seaweed or straw on the beach.
I can't imagine why that would be.
It's like straw on the beach. Weird.
Weird and fucking incriminating.
That's amazing.
Thank you. I nailed it.
Yeah. When Carrie says that the police took her back to the farm after giving a statement, I'd seriously be tempted to ask the police if there was somewhere else I could stay because I'd be terrified.
Right? Asking me to face Mazu after just being responsible for her daughter drowning? Yeah, there's not a chance in hell. Mm-mm. Take me into productive custody. I mean, yeah. If there's a thing called productive custody where I get stuff done.
Is that what we need to put you in order to get you to do the blog post?
Productive custody. That needs to be a thing. Can we get, invent it, make $1 billion.
Protective custody, you mean?
Take me into protective custody.
Yeah.
Time for witness protection, because I'm not going back to standing in front of that woman.
I wonder if Abigail made her come back somehow, said you have to, you know.
God, yeah.
Because she was afraid of what she'd say. She wanted control over her. Oh. And then there's all this confusion about whether Jonathan Wace was supposed to have been there that morning or not. But what was the truth? It was that he was going to go away with Rose, right? But because Rose and her family had escaped, he didn't leave, right?
I think that was it.
I think that's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Then there's this part where she breaks down crying again because she said the Waces had every right to be mad. She said, if someone had taken one of my little, and then she starts crying. I mean, I have to imagine that becoming a mother has made the weight of her guilt over her role in this little girl's death even heavier for her. It has to.
Oh, yeah. Almost assuredly.
Yeah.
When Robin silently mimed to Strike an offer of comfort to Carrie, Strike shook his head. Doubtless he'd be accused of heartlessness again on the return journey. He knows her too well. But yeah. He wanted to hear Carrie's own words, not her response to somebody else's sympathy or ire.
Oh, that part made me laugh so much. I could just see Robin giving him a look, but I'm also thinking, why should he give her sympathy?
Maybe Robin thought it might help to build a rapport between them so that Shuri would open up.
Maybe. He's right to not be too sympathetic, right? Or I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I don't know. I guess so. His reasoning makes sense. But, you know, on the other hand, Robin has gotten so much out of witnesses by being sympathetic to them in the past. I don't know if any one strategy would be right here, but maybe he senses that Shuri wants to let something out and he doesn't want to get in the way of it.
I get the feeling that his spidey senses are tingling a bit here because he pushes her a little. In just a bit, he starts asking her about what she means by her choice of words when she talked to Leonard Heaton and saying, I could have stopped it.
Yeah, he's picking up on the strange word choice and all of its possible implications.
He is suspicious because she is sus.
Yeah, but you know, Robin can be the sympathy. He can be
good cop, bad
the
cop.
One that pushes. Yes, exactly.
I've regretted it all my life. All my life, Carrie sobbed, raising her swollen-eyed face, tears still coursing down her cheeks. I felt like I didn't deserve Poppy and Daisy when I had them. I shouldn't have agreed. Why did I do it? Why? I've asked myself that over and over, but I swear I never wanted... I was young. I knew it was wrong. I never wanted it to happen. Oh, God. And then she was dead, and it was real. It was real.
I think this is all absolutely true. I think that what we're seeing here is Carrie talking about what actually happened.
Yes.
Yeah, I agree. This feels like a genuine reaction to what she and the others actually did to Dayu the night before.
She says, I knew it was wrong. That's like, I never wanted it to happen. Yeah, I never wanted her to drown. You know, I shouldn't have agreed. You could say she shouldn't have agreed with Dayu, but I knew it was wrong.
Yeah.
It's a bit beyond what supposedly happened, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. I do feel bad for her.
I feel really bad for her. I mean, I know that she's complicit in Dayu's death and in covering it up. But what she did is, to me, very different from Rainey actually strangling and dismembering a child. I think Shuri did her best to convince herself that it wasn't real, that it was all a big joke, and that Dayu wasn't going to die. And I have to think that she would have been a very sympathetic figure to a jury. And that if she'd cooperated and testified against Abigail, she might not have had to do a ton of time in prison. Like, she's an accessory to murder. Yes, she's a conspirator, but she's not a murderer.
Yeah, it reminds me a little bit of Linda Kasabian, who was, I can't remember which night, but she drove the Manson, some of the Manson family to one of the houses. And then she turned state witness, right, and was given immunity because she didn't do anything. She didn't go inside, but she was there. She drove them there. I think she drove or she was in the car, something like that.
Yeah.
There's this little aside about social workers because Strike is asking Carrie if she remembered the Graves is wanting to take Dayu and raise her. And she said that she remembered something about it, but she thought social workers wanted to take Dayu away. Then she randomly says that they have too much power and that a friend of hers who fosters had a difficult time. Why do you think this is dropped in here? Is it a clue to the shady illegal baby trafficking? Is Carrie afraid of social workers because she's afraid someone will find out that she's involved in a child's death?
I read this as sort of a desperate attempt of Shuri's to derail the interview and shift topics, like grasping at any straw she could. And also as sort of more evidence to her personality that she absorbs the views of people she's close to, like a little parrot.
Yeah. You know? That makes sense, yeah.
I like the shady baby trafficking connection.
Here's another thing that reminds me of the Jordan Rainey interview where Carrie becomes incredibly defensive and upset when they get way too close to the truth. They're asking her if she ever gave the kids something to make them sleep that night, and Robin tells her that Emily Purbright saw her helping Dayu out the window, and her reaction to this told me immediately that this was true.
Yeah, she was hella defensive, wasn't she?
And she turned pink. The blush of guilt.
Oh, who was that in Troubled Blood? It was Cynthia, right?
Yeah, I think so. And Douthwaite, too. Like, I think a couple of people blushed in that one. Troubled Blood.
Douthwaite was the one that had the, with the Troubled Blood in the epigraph?
No, I think that was Cynthia.
I think they both blushed.
No, but the epigraph actually says Troubled Blood in the epigraph for, hold on.
Did it? Well, now I'm going to look it up.
Yeah, because they were in Skegness, right?
Yeah. It was part 6, chapter 64 with the Troubled Blood epigraph. So that was definitely Douthwaite. Yeah.
All right. What is the Cynthia one then? Because I thought I remembered something about blushing.
Maybe. Part 4, chapter 35. Fair Aurora rising hastily doth by her blushing tell that she did lie.
There you go, blushing.
Is that the Cynthia chapter?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. So they both had it.
Yeah.
Both there you go. Them. Yeah. Guilty face.
Yeah. I think at this point, we had enough information to probably guess that Dayu never actually made it to the beach.
Yeah.
I didn't guess it, but we could have.
We could have. So, yeah.
Here's another thing that maybe should have clicked. They talk about Dayu hanging around with the older kids and that they gave her special toys or candy. Yeah. Carrie denies that this was her because she wasn't allowed to have either of those things, which is true. Yeah. Earlier in the chapter, they talk about Dayu getting special treatment because she was one of the Wace's children. The only other person who this possibly could be is Abigail. Not only would she be considered an older kid, but she's the only one who would have been allowed special treatment and had access to those things.
Yeah,
that's true.
This makes me feel very dumb. Yeah, the only other one, it would have been Abigail.
Yeah.
I bought into her sort of Cinderella story. I did buy into it. I'm like, she was the leftovers, the chopped liver next door kind of thing.
Yeah. The next part is so hard for me to read. I don't think Stryker Robin enjoyed this part either. When they show Carrie the pictures of the Polaroids and tell her that they know it's her. I mean, that can't be fun.
No. She confirms the one man is Paul Draper, probably because he's dead and can't give anything away, but lies about the other two, saying it's Joe and Rose.
Yeah, of course we know Strike is right that the other man is Jordan Rini. He just hasn't figured out yet that the other woman is Abigail.
So I'm wondering, did she definitely pick the name Rose at random because she liked flower names? Because I doubt that she remembered Rosie Fernsby after all that time. Although maybe that's just my shitty memory talking. And any thoughts on why Joe? I kind of felt like she was scrambling and couldn't think of anything other than a variation on Jordan. It's like Joe. You know, the names are so similar. I think she just got lucky that her random lies were actually real people in the church.
I don't know. I think she might remember the name Joe.
Mm.
I can also see her remembering Rosie because the details of this night are probably still pretty strong.
Mm.
You know, but the flower thing is also believable. So I don't really know.
It is. Can I say I really love the little flower names for girls? Because Poppy and Daisy are so cute.
They are cute, yeah.
Rose, Lily, Flora kind of counts as well.
Ooh, yeah. I feel really bad for her when Robin asks if she was forced to do it. And she shakes her head yes, meaning the Polaroids. But I kind of think that she's thinking about all of it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
That's when I definitely have more empathy for her. And I think about the control that Abigail must have had over her.
This line... It looked as though the woman had vacated her body. Robin had never seen anybody who so resembled a somnambulist. Every muscle in her face slack, her eyes blank. It's just such a vivid picture because it tells us just how much of a shock these photos were to her. She's not herself anymore. She's left the building. I don't think that she is thinking straight now from this point to the end.
I think when we talked earlier about her saying that it was real, she must have hoped that Abigail was bluffing. Maybe Abigail threatened to kill them sometimes if she didn't do what she wanted. I don't know. Threaten them somehow. We know that Abigail threatens people. You know, she's just reminded us of it in the last chapter when she tells Strike about threatening Patrick and Barry.
Yeah.
What do you guys think about her ringtone that just interrupts everything with the I like to party. Everybody does make love and listen to music. You've got to let yourself go, 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 go. I didn't know this. I had to look this song up because I didn't know it.
Yeah, I didn't recognize it at all.
Even when I listened to it, I didn't know it.
Yeah, I didn't either. This song apparently came out in 2003, which I think is around 8 years after she left the UHC.
I know that's the year I graduated high school, so.
That was 8 years before I graduated high school.
All right. I don't know. It's just a weird, it's strange to have this song in there. I like to party. This is not a party happening.
The ending of this chapter is so sad when you know what's about to happen when they leave.
I know. I wish she would have let Strike finish that last sentence instead of screaming at them to go. He started to say that if she had been forced to do something she didn't want to do, I bet he was going to tell her that she might have been given immunity or a good deal or something if she testified.
Yeah.
And like you were saying earlier, Pools, I think that's fair too, because she wasn't hands-on, so to speak, when it came to the actual murder, because she could have had a life. She could have been a good witness. She could have done the right thing and got justice for Dayu, you know?
Yeah,
it wasn't too late.
It wasn't. He would have tried to convince her that she could testify and come off looking, you know, if not sympathetic, then at least not like the real villain.
I do think she would have looked sympathetic.
She would have. She's another Douthwaite. Douthwaite was afraid of how it would look after all these years running. I mean, this is a much worse version of that.
Right.
But she came forward. If she said that it's time now, I'm not scared of her anymore.
I know.
That could have worked. It would have pulled really the jury's heartstrings.
When you think of that option,
yeah,
it's just so hard to understand this choice. You know, her little girls could have still had their mom and she could have helped get justice for Dayu, since obviously she feels terrible about it. I don't know. I'm back to thinking about Charlotte. I'm not really sure why.
I think at this point, Sheree is in such a state that she's not actually thinking clearly. And then she calls Abigail, who I'm sure does not help her calm down or think rationally at all. It seems to me that all of those years of guilt and shame, the weight of that combined with the shock and the fear of this interview, plus Abigail on the phone, maybe even pushing her to kill herself to protect Abigail, obviously, I think it all combined into this horrible, tragic decision.
I can absolutely see Abigail pushing her to kill herself because she's probably scared she'll crack. Which makes Robin's guilt for this so sad, because it's Abigail's fault, not hers.
I feel so bad for Robin.
I think Cherie's death is absolutely on Abigail.
Yeah.
But oh man, that's a bummer to end the chapter on, isn't it?
It is. We might have to have an emergency post-cult chapter cleanse.
A PCCC.
Yes. Exactly.
Did you have something in mind?
I did. I had a thought because some of our cult chapter cleanses have been touching on lines from Lethal White, aka the book that is the literal goldmine of endgame relationship foreshadowing.
It really is.
And there's one line I am dying to have come back, especially if we're due for some Lethal White parallels in the next book, which is, and I know that you know the line that I'm talking about, "For one moment of madness, Strike yearned to say, 'Come with me,' but there are words that can never be unsaid or forgotten. And those he knew were some of them." What if he says it in Hallmark Man?
And Robin says yes. And speaking of words that can't be unsaid or forgotten, he's said some now.
Exactly. Yeah.
Robin says yes. Come with me.
Ken.
Yes.
Do you mean this in a... Do you mean in a dirty way or a regular way?
Oh my God.
Did I know you were gonna take it there?
Well, now I gotta go write that fanfic.
I genuinely don't know what you mean.
God damn it.
For the record, I mean the regular way. I mean, okay. I'll take the X-rated way too. I just don't think we're gonna get to see that.
I mean, big Sam.
Sadly.
Okay. All right.
It's fine.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Give me a scenario of what you actually meant, though, because, I'm here for this.
I'm not sure that I had an exact scenario in mind, because, I mean, I'm sure Joe could come up with situations a million times better than I can, but maybe it could be something that's like kind of under those similar circumstances of, you know, when it happens in Lethal White, especially if she decides to double down on being with Murphy and makes the same sort of like attempts at taking her relationship with Murphy seriously that Strike did with Madeline, but like kind of having the momentum of her faking her feelings, maybe ending up getting her into a messy situation that she needs to escape from. But regardless, whatever the situation is, you know, it ends up being this thing where she can either do this thing that she feels pressured to go through with or follow her heart. And Strike is giving her an out and continuing with saying and doing things that move their relationship forward that he can't take back or forget happened.
I'm the alternative standing right here,
Robin. I'm the alternative. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Should we go to our partner's chat?
Partner's chat.
How's everybody doing?
Good. Sorry, I'm just fiddling with my camera because like Narcissus, when my reflection is on the screen, I must stare at it. I can't look. So it's got to be like right
on. It's good to know that you're not looking at like my face then.
Never. Who looks at other people's faces on Zoom? You're monitoring yourself 100% of the time for me. It's very distracting. I'm like, gotta hold my chin out, gotta do this.
Well, good to know. I guess I could just sit there and make faces and you'll never know.
I might not notice you getting murdered as long as it was quiet.
I'll try to keep my murder quiet for you so you can look at yourself. Yeah.
Well, I don't like looking at myself. It's a compulsion.
Oh, so it's the opposite of my toddler whose favorite thing to do is look at herself in the mirror.
Oh, that's cute.
She plays peekaboo with herself.
Aw.
Gives herself all the kisses.
That's very sweet. Kenz, we can't hear you.
I thought she was just quiet laughing.
Yeah, no. I was like very silent.
Can you hear me now?
There we go. Yeah.
I was about to say, I was trying to like say something off of our last conversation and I was like, well, shit, Jesus, you just blew me the hell off. It's like, gee. Just like, okay, yeah, moving on. Like, okay, I guess, well, we're not sharing today.
Poor Kenz.
Sorry. I'm in a bit of denial right now.
I'm not
getting sick. I'm fine. I'm completely fine.
Sure.
We're just because I couldn't sleep because my throat was on fire.
That's normal.
Doesn't mean anything.
No.
Did I still make reservations for Disneyland on Thursday? Yeah, I did.
Even if you were getting sick, you'd be better by Thursday. That's like a week away.
Right? Yeah. But the way that it works is that then my kids will have it. So I still couldn't go.
I think that your only option is to immediately quarantine yourself in a very beautiful hotel room alone with a spa and room service.
I think it's a little too late because I was already sharing a Capri Sun with Abby yesterday.
Oh, no.
So we'll see how that goes. Fingers I have been to Disneyland 3 times in the last 2 weeks, so it's bound to happen.
How often do you go in Disney season? Is it Disney season? Like, what is...
No, this is my normal life. It's just that COVID threw it off, and you've never known me in normal life.
Oh, okay. So you do just go to Disneyland just constantly?
All the time. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Cool.
Nice.
Don't you at some point have seen everything?
No.
Okay. Mm-hmm. It's all brand new every time?
Yeah.
Exciting. Okay. Mm-hmm. Cool.
And there's... food. You've seen from my text messages with my cousins that I showed you that we think about food
constantly.
Yeah, it's our first thought. Where are we eating? Anyway, that's what I meant to know.
You're going to be fine. You're not getting sick.
No, I'm totally not. I'm fine. I feel great too. I didn't get tired from just walking around.
No.
Nope.
No, I'm fine.
Really good sign.
Yeah.
Just watch. We're going to like finish recording and you're going to be like,
crash. I know.
Yeah. Curse her tens.
My voice is probably going to be gone. It doesn't hurt as bad as it did in the middle of the night. So
maybe all you need to do is actually, maybe you haven't been talking enough and your throat's trying to warn you that you need to talk a lot.
That's probably it.
That makes sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
Logic tracks.
I finished another book that I liked.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Tell us about it.
It was called Hidden Pictures by Jason. Okay, I've never said his last name out loud. I'm not quite sure. Jason Rakulik.
Uh-huh.
That sounds right.
Sure.
I've actually got tricked into this, sort of.
Oh.
I saw it on TikTok and in like the crime thriller videos. Yeah. So it's about this young woman. She's 19. She's a recovering addict who goes to work for a family as a nanny. And then the kid starts drawing creepy pictures of a murder.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I thought it was going to be this kid witnessed something and doesn't remember and that kind of thing. But it turns out, this is why I was tricked into it, it's a ghost crime.
Ghost crime.
Ghost crime. And I probably wouldn't have started reading it because I'm a baby.
Mm-hmm.
But this actually wasn't scary. I read the whole thing. Oh. Wasn't scary. But I really enjoyed it. I liked the pictures.
Oh.
They get
creepy.
Well, they start out kind of creepy kid, but then they get really detailed, really good drawings.
Interesting.
And J.K. Rowling was mentioned by name in the book.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. Nice. It was kind of a, you should write this down. Oh, I don't know how to write. Not everyone's J.K. Rowling. So I liked that.
That's a good shout out.
I know. It made me happy. But speaking of books, my cousin Savannah, she started reading Strike. She started listening to Cuckoo's Calling.
Nice.
Aww, so she sent me some texts. I was going to read just some of them. I mean, it's not a ton. Hold on. She's really enjoying it. Okay. She said, Strike is starting to question who called the paparazzi. I knew there was going to be something with that.
Yeah.
And it's funny because I remember us talking about that it's actually a really good red herring that makes you think that Kieran Calavis Jones did it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right? So asking good questions, but she's
paying attention to clues, like trying to think about the murder. That'll stop by like before.
She's suspicious of Wilson right now, which I guess is fair, I guess. And then she said, and the two guys who were running, I'm thinking they didn't know each other.
Oh.
And that one of the guys is the killer.
Oh, so, she's a little smarty pants.
I know.
Good for her.
I told her, I can't wait for you to find out the killer on this one.
Yeah, that's exciting.
Yeah, and I did tell her that we all have a book crush on Strike.
Well, I think you understated that quite a bit.
I did a little bit. I'm excited that she's reading them. I told her that I was going to talk about it today when we were recording, and that I would ask her for updates so that I can share her reading journey with everyone.
Yeah, keep us updated. We want to hear about how Savannah's getting on.
Yeah, I will.
So I haven't read any. Well, I've been sort of reading, but not really. But have gotten into knitting again because every few years I'm like, I should get back into knitting again. And then, you know, I try for a bit and then, you know, I forget. But this time I think I'm doing real good this time and it's going to stick. I'm going to be the person who like knits things.
What have you started?
Oh, okay. Well, right now I'm doing this scarf. I brought it so I could do show and tell.
Oh, we should do show and tell.
Yes.
Oh, nice. It's very fancy.
Yeah, it's fisherman's rib, which made me think of really thick sweaters on Cornish fishermen, which obviously makes me think of Strike.
Understood.
So, and this was just the yarn that I had left over from last time I tried to become a knitter.
Nice.
So that's why it's like red, but I think it's turning out pretty good, right?
It is. Mm-hmm. I could never do that. I don't know how to knit. Yeah, all.
It looks pretty good. It's a pretty easy pattern. So next up, I'm doing a baby blanket because my husband's coworker just had their baby very premature. So they're still in the hospital.
I think
that by the time I finish the blanket, they'll probably maybe be home.
Oh, that's good. Yeah.
But yeah, so I am knitting.
Cool. I knit too.
You knit too, Kenz?
Yes, I do.
Ooh, show and tell. Show and tell. Kenz is knitting.
Yeah. So it's okay. Let me see if it'll show it up. Show it up. But yeah, it was supposed to be like a Slytherin type deal.
You know what? I was feeling nice. Slytherin from that. Yeah.
I like it.
Mm-hmm. Nice. Yeah. It's just, I mainly do scarves just because I can't be bothered to learn how to do anything else. It's really just to keep my hands and brain busy.
I'm glad that you're a fellow knitter. And as I'm knitting it, I'm like, you know what? This is going to be really useful in the apocalypse. So it's definitely how I categorize all of my skills. I'm like, is this going to be useful when society collapses and we're all screwed? Will this benefit our local compound when we're struggling to survive?
Are you going to stab people with your knitting needles?
Well, if they come too close, I might. But mostly it'll be for warm socks. Because you know what? People are all like, men are all like, you got to be ready to shoot people and, you know, knife people and all kinds of, you know, you got to fight in the apocalypse. And I'm like, no, you got to have warm feet.
What okay? Men are you talking to?
Oh, too many men on the internet. What's really important is warm feet, a stash of antibiotics, and food and water sources that won't kill you from like dysentery or salmonella.
I'd rather just go out at the beginning.
Yeah, you'd rather just die. Do you have any apocalypse skills?
None?
Okay.
No, not unless someone needed a podcast edited or a cake.
Baking is a useful apocalypse skill because we're going to need cake more than ever. There won't be much fun stuff.
I'm not sure anybody needs fancy decorated cakes in an apocalypse.
Okay, they might need somebody to help take care of children, though.
There you go. Yeah. Thank you, Kenz, for finding me a skill.
That's an important skill.
Knowing how to talk to and take care of children, I feel like, is an underrated skill.
Thank you.
What about you, Kenz? Do you have any apocalypse skills?
No. No, not really. I can make people laugh. I can stab them with my knitting needles.
Very good. Okay.
I can keep the morale up.
There you go.
Morale's important.
I also know how to boss people around when I need to. So like
leadership.
I guess, you know, that could work.
You know what? I could do that too.
I'm very good at bossing people around. I'm not very good at being bossed around.
We know. Going back to cake though, I'm supposed to be making a cake this weekend if I'm not sick.
Oh.
What kind of cake are you making?
Which I'm not.
You're not.
I've already made the cake itself. It's in the freezer. Mm-hmm. I still need to decorate it. My cousin Lisa is pregnant and I was the one, the doctor sent me the sex of the baby.
It's a gender reveal cake.
Okay. Yes.
Are you going to tell us what it is?
You want to know?
We won't tell Lisa.
it's a girl.
Oh, good.
Okay. Which is what I was hoping for. So I made a strawberry cake and I'm going to put the frosting that's going to go in the middle. I'll dye pink and then everything's going to be white. I have a bunch of white pearl sprinkles that I'm going to put all over and gold stars. And then it has a gold sign that says it's a .. Mm-hmm.
That's exciting. You have to show us the cake once it's done.
I will.
And also try to get me a piece of it somehow.
Sure.
Okay. So let's talk about Tortured Poets Department because I don't think I've listened to anything else for the past week.
No, me either.
Yeah. On
nothing.
Repeat.
Yeah. Just perfect from start to finish. I mean, not an entire skip in all 31.
Yeah. It's a pretty good album. I really enjoyed it.
Well, anyone want to share what their favorites are?
Down Bad.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's narcotics in that song for sure.
So goddamn catchy.
I really liked that video of the woman who's like crying but twerking at the same time. You see that one? So really good.
Yeah, it was so funny. Yes. I also like LOML.
That song's very sad.
So sad.
Very.
Ooh, Guilty as Sin.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Kenz, you said that gave you Robin vibes thinking about Strike. And I was like, can we get that, please?
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Yeah, that entire second verse. Oh, yeah. 100%. Ooh. Yeah. I keep these longings locked in lowercase inside a vault. We've already done it in my head.
Mm. Yeah. Same. Yeah. They've done it in my head too.
And everyone's heads. Yeah. I too got a lot of Robin from Guilty as Sin. I want to do an edit for it. And what's the other? Oh, Who's afraid of little old me?
That might be my favorite thing that's ever happened.
Oh, it's so good.
So good.
Well, you should be. People have been doing these edits that she should do it for the Reputation transition. I'm like, oh my God, that would be so good. Who's afraid of little? You should be. And then it's like, down. Yeah. I Hate It Here was also very relatable for me.
Yes.
I have a lot of escapist into not here elsewhere in my brain sometimes. Mm-hmm.
I think from the first 16, my favorites are going to be Fortnite, Down Bad, But Daddy, I Love Him, Guilty as Sin, and I Can Fix Him. No, Really, I Can. Especially But Daddy, I Love Him.
That's my other favorite.
And then as far as the extras, I think I would go for The Black Dog, I'm Gonna Get You Back, I Hate It Here, I Look in People's Windows, and Cassandra.
I like I Look in People's Windows just because of the Twilight edits to it.
I've like, seen some of those, yeah. So, But Daddy, I Love Him and Who's Afraid of Little Me are my two favorites. Mm-hmm. There's a line in But Daddy, I Love Him that just makes me think of Robin with Linda, which is perfect for the episode we're about to record. When it says,
I'd rather burn my whole life down than listen to one more second of all this bitching and moaning.
Tell me that's not Robin with Linda.
Yes.
Yeah, but I mean, I like My Boy Only Breaks His Favorite Toys, Down Bad, obviously, But Daddy, I Love Him, mm-hmm. Guilty of Sin, Who's Afraid of Little Me. I like The Alchemy and The Albatross. Yes. I like Thank You, Amy. I really like Peter, too. I love the Peter Pan connections and the melody is really good. It's all good. I think this is probably going to be my favorite of hers.
I think it's my favorite album of hers, too. It's a vibe. It's just a groove. The whole way through, I'm grooving, and yet I'm also really heartbroken, and yet I'm also like, yes, fuck yes.
I'm crying in the club.
And so High School is really cute, too.
It is. It is. The songs that she has about Travis are adorable.
Oh, how did I mention So Long London? I love So Long London.
The sad songs are harder for me to listen to because I don't like sad songs.
I love the sad songs. I don't like the high school ones. Like I just don't relate to it.
What do you mean by the high school ones?
Like So High School, or when she relates things to high school energy, or like, you know, like So High School is one, but there are other ones that had that kind of vibe to me that I just didn't quite get. But I connect with the sad songs really well.
You mean Happy?
Yeah, Happy I don't connect to very well. Yeah, I think that would be
okay.
That would be accurate. Yeah, I would say. Oh, ouch.
All right. What are we doing next time, Kenz?
We are doing chapters 98 through 100. And in those chapters, Murphy and Robin watch Becca's interview with the police and Charlie is found dead.
Okay. So next chapter, all the goodwill for Murphy is gone out the window.
These last two episodes,
I've been nice to him.
We've been very understanding.
I've been kind
of Murphy.
But you hush me when I'm yelling at the TV? Absolutely.
It's going
not.
Down. It's going down, down next time.
Mm-hmm. Hands are being thrown. Shots are being fired. Watch out, bud. We're coming for you.
All of our niceness is going out the window.
Gone.
All good.
Oh, I'm excited now. I'm revved up. I'm gonna dive right into this.
Fired up.
That'll do it for this episode. Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoy what you've heard, don't forget to follow us on social media. We're on Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr at The SE Files Pod. You can also contact us on our website at thesefilespod.com or email us directly at sefilespodcast@gmail.com. Thank you so much again for listening, and we hope to catch you next time for another episode of The Strike and Ellicott Files.